Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. This show is brought to you by Swarbricks, the first law firm in New Zealand to accept Bitcoin for legal services. The team at Swarbricks are Bitcoiners, and they get it. They are a general practice firm, so they can provide advice in a range of legal areas, as well as specific advice related to Bitcoin. Swarbricks offers a 20% discount for services paid in Bitcoin. Find out more at swarbricks.co.nz/Bitcoin. Now, today is a special Matariki episode. I catch up with some of the Wellington Bitcoin crew here at the studio. BitKiwi Paul and Conrad Hurin, and Troy joins us at the end. We go deep into the language of value, the philosophy of ASIC mining, proof of work, and how it all connects. I do hope you enjoyed this episode. If you want to get in touch with me, please send an email to hello@thetransformationofvalue.com and I will get back to you. Otherwise, on to the show. So the sound of the miner is a non-issue. I do like it though, it's quite zen-like.
It is, it's like white noise.
Yeah.
Could put you to sleep.
Yeah.
It's working hard, so it makes you work hard.
Yeah. I mean, it's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
Thank you, Paul. You helped me build it.
You're welcome.
The Noah's Ark of ASIC mining. Well, there's two of everything. Well, there's actually only one, but it's enough. It's able to self-replicate.
Oh, I love it. Every time I come in here and see it now, I'm like, yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. There's something about having a miner or two.
Mm.
It just, I know it feels like power, you know, like, but it's like, I also have a certain reverence for it. And in a way, are you guys familiar with like Warhammer 40K?
I'm aware of the words put together like that.
Okay. So I'm not, I don't know much about it, but there's this lore, this kind of, you know, this canon associated with it, that in the future you've got these like advanced civilizations, but they kind of worship science and engineering in a very religious way. And it's, I mean, it's like a game, and but they bring it together. And so you've got these like engineers who like,
but they
treat it like you would treat, because, you know, historically religions and cultures, you know, they take objects that were like everyday and then they glorify them and they kind of put them on a pedestal, literally. And so you've got these engineers who are like fixing things and they're kind of keeping the engines going on these like space shuttles and stuff. And in a way, I wonder whether like the ASIC will take on this idol image. I mean, it's very, there's a discussion there, a serious conversation around religious imagery, but, you know, what is a miner? What, you know, what does it stand for? What is the image of a, of Bitcoin's logo? Like these kinds of visuals, what do they mean in the context 100 years from now? You know? Sorry, that's a bit.
Damn.
That's good.
If you read the history of Christianity, actually, the they called it the cult of the cross in the old days, and the imagery wasn't sort of locked in at that point in the early days. And so, you know, the idea of the cross, and in some religions they don't even talk about the cross really, and they actually talk to say it's like it was just a pole, you know, it wasn't there wasn't like the cross beam. And this imagery is like so powerful, but it solidifies and kind of ossifies over time, and it becomes very sensitive, you know, you can't touch it, you can't change it. But we're at the period right now where it's like it's still very fluid, you know, you can meet these people and they're still floating around, they're open source devs, it's not untouchable, you know. That's the human side of it. The code itself is unchangeable, but it's like all the core parameters are.
And any part of it that has become untouchable has already started gathering like a mythical status, like Satoshi Nakamoto.
Yeah.
Now with Hal Finney even having passed away some time ago now, people revere him in that kind of way.
Yeah. Well, it takes on the myth of it, like the image is unchanging upon death. You know, like the idol, you know, is kind of immaculate, you know, posthumously. And you don't get that with Vitalik because he's just floating around, you know, like, but these kind of characters are larger than life. And the imagery of that is really powerful, I think.
Well, you see it with Satoshi in particular, that, you know, that statue that turned into a bit of an image of how they view him or her or them. It's a pretty amazing story. It's like there's a great film in there, surely at some point. But yeah, that's definitely like, yeah, personally I do not want us to ever find out who that person was or that group or them ever to reappear, because I love it just the way it is.
Well, one of the other considerations that the Chinese communists talked about this quite a lot was the cult of personality. And you saw this around Mao Zedong and some of the leaders who took on mythical status during their life, but then also after. And there was a real challenge with that. And it took a couple of successive leaders to undo that work of the image of Mao Zedong in China. And they had to basically like knuckle down and just get stuff done. And we're seeing a reemergence of that with Xi Jinping, and he's kind of putting books out there, and he's got his face on everything, and you know, people square, and you know, the image of the person as a representation of the party or the ideology, it becomes religious naturally. It's just a human function, and you do have to be conscious that that is a thing. Though I think one of the powerful things about Bitcoin is that it also rejects the cult of the personality, in that those who make it to the top, they end up either not staying humble and stacking sats, or they go on to other things.
100%, and that's why people like Satoshi and Hal Finney, etc., are so revered, is because for every one of them, there's 100. I mean, they literally called Roger Ver the Bitcoin Jesus, and now look, like there's so many of them. It's littered with it, and it's happening all the time. We saw it not that long ago with Nick Carter and these kind of guys. They all fall by the wayside.
I think, I mean, we all need to be conscious of this at a personal level as well. You know, we're in the early days here of what Bitcoin in New Zealand could mean. How do we stay humble and stack sats? How do we make sure that we don't fall into the iconoclastic chasm that these others have fallen into so far before us, you know? And the only answer that I can come up with is that we need to read our philosophy and make sure that we're following the wisdom of those who came before. You know, we are nothing, we know nothing. But I don't know, what are your thoughts, Conrad, Paul?
I think also just focusing on like adding value to the people who are alive and are around, like not trying to think of, oh, how can I become an idol that will survive past my death or whatever. Just be like, oh, how can I serve the people who exist now and who really cares after I die? Well, not who cares, but like, I'm not trying to leave a huge legacy.
Are you familiar with Marcus Aurelius, either of you?
Read the name. Yeah. Haven't read anything he's written.
Meditations. It's a great... there's a couple of like public domain versions of his meditations, which came out, you know, thousands of years ago. The one from like the 19th century is quite good, actually. But he talks about how you will quickly turn to dust.
Mm-hmm.
And then those who remembered your name will also turn to dust, and then there's nothing. And it's just kind of... Because he was the emperor of Rome... it was just, I think, prior to Christ. So it was just sort of in that pre-Christian era. And his meditations, you know, they're really just sort of his diary to himself. And it was a very stoic, you know, stoic philosophy. And I read it quite a lot just on the Kindle. And it really is quite grounding because it's his own personal memos. He didn't actually intend for anyone to read it. And he kind of talks about this, you know, how you will always return back to the earth, you know, and this kind of idea that he was the king of the world, the emperor of Rome, the greatest man in the world, and yet the Stoic philosophy that he used was also possible for this sort of the lowest of the low, you know, slaves and soldiers and working class people. And there's something quite unifying about that. It's quite powerful.
Yeah.
I saw a quote just from him the other day about, I can't remember the words, but something about, you know, to lead a, there's actually not much to leading a happy life. And it actually has nothing to do with your status or wealth. I can't remember the words he put it in a really great way. But I read it and it did make me wonder. It's timely that you brought him up, because I was like, man, I have seen these Aurelius quotes popping up all over the place and they always blow my mind. Maybe I need to read this.
it's good stuff. And the format that it's in is just these little slight one sentences. Like they're not... It's not like a book as such. It's just kind of these little notes. And so you can just pick it up and open to a page and there's something relevant. And it really is quite grounding, because I think we have a modernity, contemporary bias where we look at today and we think this is the best it could ever be and society is at its pinnacle. But if you go back, and I've been reading about some Greek literature as well recently, you look at, you know, Homer, the Iliad, the Odyssey, these kind of pieces of literature from, you know, ancient civilization, literally, and the power in the words and the stories and the archetypes are just so magnificent. to think that they came up with this, they didn't have word processors, they didn't have Twitter, they didn't have computers, they didn't have any of that stuff. And in a way, that actually enabled better work to come out. And we can learn a lot from the ancients, just as we can learn a lot from those who came before us in any era. And in fact, there's a lot that I think we don't know that has been lost to history.
I find that all the time, where I've sort of come upon a philosophy or a saying or something that improves my own mentality and how to live. And then I'm always quite surprised at finding out how old this particular piece of insight is. And you're just constantly reminded that, yeah, we might have new technologies that haven't been seen before, but a lot of our personal philosophy and thinking, it's just repeated over and over. And these messages have been around for thousands of years, and yet all of us personally are discovering them for the first time during our lives. And it's actually not, most of it hasn't been taught or ingrained into us at all previously in life. If anything, it's been questioned, and then we're discovering them later and realizing how much truth there is to this. And actually, I don't need somebody to teach me this or tell me that this is the best way to live. I've just figured it out for myself.
Yeah. Well, also at a very simplistic level, if you look at the history of the Renaissance, and there's this great book I've got, The Classical Tradition, Gilbert Hehit, and he talks about how the Renaissance emerged and how ancient, you know, Greek and Latin, Roman stuff inspired, you know, local vernacular languages, because like English, for example, was just nothing, you know, it was just kind of like, you know, Anglo-Saxon kind of grunts, you know, and they were able to learn from the great stories and then kind of take that. And you had, I think, the emergence of Beowulf was like the first great English text, but that took these kind of pieces from other stories that had come before, these kind of epics, but they were like kind of imitating it in a way. And now English is, you know, so broad and diverse, it's able to encompass all of that. It kind of I'm just thinking, it almost is like it's been able to integrate all of the other great stuff of these other languages. And so Greek and Latin influence on English is huge, and it's like an open protocol. And that was what, you know, arguably is what made English, you know, the lingua franca of the world, is it could integrate French and, you know, I mean, even a word, so abstract nouns, so any word that ends like connection, you know, that T-I-O-N at the end of a word, that makes it an abstract noun. That's extremely powerful, but we inherited that from the Greeks.
Well, every part of the language was inherited from somewhere, almost every part, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like most of it, yeah.
Yeah, like you saw the Germanic words have like the difference between the Germanic rooted words and the Latin rooted words. So like brother is a very Germanic, very to the earth, very grounded. But then like fraternity, fraternal, that's very lightweight, it's very Latin. And the difference in context, like fraternal and brotherly, same meaning, but actually very different. Mm. Brotherly love, fraternal love, actually have very different kinds of vibe. But a lot of languages only have one of those. And so this, apparently, I don't speak Spanish, apparently like the fraternal and the kind of the way you'd say it in Spanish, they don't have that same ability to say it as you would say like brotherly, very Germanic, very Saxon kind of a way of saying it. I don't know anything though, but
yeah, because you can say brotherly love and you can convey that kind of message about the blood of the covenant being thicker than the water of the womb, right? Like you can convey a brother who's your brother in arms rather than your literal brother.
Yeah. The other language that's been able to do that quite well is Japanese. Is like really? they have this such, you know, originally Chinese influence, but then also their local language, and they kind of came together maybe like 8th, 9th century. And so you have like every word almost has like two ways of saying it. So there's the Japanese way, which is, it's hard to describe, it's very round and soft language, and then the Chinese way of saying a word, which is very hard. And so you find often like street signs or like commands are in the Chinese, where it's like two or three characters, but then the Japanese way is a lot longer and kind of flowing and kind of familial. So for example, the word stop in Chinese, like the Chinese kind of character would be like teishi, and it's two characters, boom, that's what you'd see on like a stop sign. But then the way of saying it in the Japanese language, like the colloquial, would be like tomarimasu, and it's a lot like I don't know, and you can play with it. So you can, there's like past tense, you can run with the words. And so it gives you this ability and the tone, and it's like a register. So the Japanese way of saying it, it's very kind of formal. You can say that within your family, but then that kind of commandment you get from Teishi, it's like what you'd see written on a sign or in a, like an official form. That's got like a different context.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something, I mean, I haven't fully grasped that myself, but I can appreciate there's a different register of language there.
I haven't been much of a studier of languages, but I'm always curious when I hear different things, and it always blows my mind when you see the difference between how a language has developed and how it's gone down a completely different path.
Yeah.
And they've just got a whole different set of things going on. And I always find it really interesting because most people, I think, myself included, when you think about language, you think, oh, it's almost like there's all these different languages. And there's almost, you think or assume that there's almost like an index of words that you can map to the languages. And so I always just find it really, like, really interesting. And I'm always asking more questions when I find out about words that only exist in one language. And when you try and translate into another, it has to be a phrase because there is no way to translate that. And I do think of, there's a few Japanese ones I know just because it's the only word. Language I did study once, but just like, as I think it's itadakimasu before you eat a meal, for example. And it always blew my mind when I was 13 learning Japanese for the first time, and they would give us a list of words and their meanings, and that was all one-to-one, and then it had itadakimasu, expression used before a meal, and I was sort of like, hang on, you need four words to describe this? And they're like, yeah, because there is literally no meaning.
Yeah.
And then they were like, moshi moshi, this is hello, but only when you answer the telephone. I was like, cool, okay, cool, that's awesome. And then it started, my mind expanded a bit, because then in the years after that, I started coming across words from all sorts of languages where there is no English translation and you have to actually explain the word. And I thought that is fascinating to me because it was a realization that languages are all developed, and I was just brought up with this English bias-centric thing where everything must map to English somehow. As a kid, that's what you assumed. And then just starting to find out all of these different things. And like what you referenced before with the M-A-S-U on the end of those words in Japanese, and how you can go into all the different tenses like mashita or mas or, and all those different things. Like, I remember learning that in Japanese. I was like, man, this is really interesting.
Yeah.
And then just the simple fact of the equivalent of the alphabet. How there was just so many more characters and sounds. And I was like, at first I was bias and was like, well, English is simpler because there's only 26, but actually then you start to realize what the problem is with that, and that there's no hard and fast rules in English. Like, there's exceptions to every rule, whereas with Japanese I was able to see that that was a, the rules were a lot more black and white because they had more a range of sounds and characters to pick from. It just seemed a lot easier for a mathematical brain like mine to understand, and I found Japanese far more logical than English once I started to learn it. I was like, well, this, I can figure out patterns, I can make sense of this. Stop telling me I before E except after C and this exception and that exception, and that's just the way it is in English. And Japanese, I was way, my math brain was way more comfortable.
It's a very logical language, and you can drag and drop.
Yeah.
You know, like, again, you got these, so the kanji, like the Chinese characters, you can kind of just drop them together and you can guess what it means. You know, like there'll be a character that like negates something or makes something big. So like shogaku, like, you know, primary school, it's like small school. And then middle school is literally like the character for middle and then school. And I mean, obviously that makes sense in English as well, but just seeing the characters, it just works. And then you get like, well, I wonder what the next one's going to be. And you can kind of guess. And even if you don't know the word, you can kind of make it up.
Yeah. I'm disappointed I never quite got much kanji in my education of it. Like, I learned the hiragana and the katakana, and then kanji would just sort of come one by one, but it always seemed a bit too, I only learned it from about 13 to about 19, and that age range I never quite knew too many kanji, but I'm glad I missed out on that now hearing that.
Yeah, though I think the other thing is it's quite a high context language as well, so it's sometimes difficult to communicate an idea like accurately. I mean, there is accuracy in the language, but to be like, like, again, English, I feel like it gives you this ability to like really be precise and also vague when you need to be. So like you can really get to the meat of a of topic, and that's why I think it has landed as the international language for engineering, computer science, technology, because it allows absolute precision, you know, and that's why they use it if you're you know, flying an airplane, air traffic control, it's all English globally. There's no mistake. You know, the word means exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
But in other languages, maybe they haven't quite got that level of precision for these technical, you know, things that transcend borders, things like technology, science, aircraft, you know, ATC, all of that stuff. It, you can't make mistakes, basically. And I wonder how this connects with, you know, this broader discussion of value, money, the international language of money, because we've seen a plurality of dialects emerge and they slip and they don't quite connect. We don't have a universal currency. We don't have a universal way of communicating value. And so there's these miscommunications in the market.
And I feel like money and value lends itself way more to a universal language. Although you mentioned a universal use of English for some things like air traffic control and whatnot, language, I think, is a lot more rooted in culture than money and value is. Although it's always been there, people aren't wedded to their currency like they are to a language. I think there's a lot more culturally to a language. And so I feel like a currency could, or a way we store and transmit value, could lend itself far more to a universal technological advancement, whereas, you know, there's like a sanctity or a beauty in language that isn't quite in your money. I don't know, maybe I'm just sort of speculating here, but that's what it feels like to me. I feel, you know, because currencies hyperinflate and then die and get replaced, and nobody necessarily mourns the death of that currency itself. But there were people mourning that, you know, like Latin is mostly faded out from use. But there is a movement. There are people that mourn that. There is, you know, it's like sort of rooted in history. They mourn that more than they mourn the sestry or whatever the currencies were in those days. So there's something a little bit more cultural with language and less so with money. And when I say less cultural with money, I mean the currency that represents it, not what it actually represents, which is very cultural, I think, in the way we deal with value, but not its face name, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if anyone has nostalgia for money, the form, the like records, CDs, old computers, old gaming consoles, they all have a nostalgia associated with them, but I don't really feel that with coinage or anything. Like
coin collectors?
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, there is a niche thing there. Yeah, but
you're right.
I think that comparison with the technology things you just mentioned, I mean, I think when Bitcoin comes in as the unit of account, that will become a thing. And we talked about that on the last time we talked, but I think that'll come, actually, when it's gone. But at the moment, yeah, you're right. There is an element of coin collecting, like there is stamp collecting, etc. But not so much.
Riffing on that, I wonder if there's a duality there, because, you know, I speak, you know, a couple of languages, really only two though, but the difference between them is that one is very communicative and precise, which is English, but then one which I use with my friends and family, and that with Japanese, it's like a lot more familial. It's a lot closer to my heart, to be fair. Like, English is just functional. And I wonder whether, I mean, English is kind of a super example, but because it can also be very creative. I guess what I'm trying to say, Bitcoin as a universal way of communicating value and money and transforming, you know, transferring value between people, but then it can also take on local meaning and enable local culture to flourish, because I mean the actual local currency doesn't really have a culture associated with it, you know. Like, I don't pine for the NZD, you know. I just want it to work, and that's the technology coming through. I just want the best technology, but then what I can do with that money can then flourish on either ends of that transaction. And it's kind of like going back to the gold standard. You can have different kinds of gold, but at the end of the day, you can have different formats for the gold to come in, different weights or different kinds of coins, but it's still gold. And then that enables the flourishing of culture on the end of that Whereas the lossy system, that is fiat money, bleeds culture, and it creates these concrete, barren societies that are struggling to find meaning and identity, potentially.
There's also always a bit of nostalgia and beauty about something when it's not common and when it's gone. Like I remember as a child, I was quite curious about money as a child, actually. And I did have a few different coins and notes from overseas and that. And I remember being fascinated by them, like looking at them and, you know, what does this picture mean? Why do they have that on the coin in Fiji or in Australia? Or because it was something I didn't see very often.
It's curious.
Yeah. And then, you know, when I had the New Zealand money in my hand, I didn't really look at it twice because you just saw it every day and that sort of thing. So I wonder when that's gone, if it's something. I'm already actually noticing a slight in myself element of curiosity with money now because I use so little cash. You see so little cash compared to what you used to. Like, you know, when I'm with my kids, that finding a coin on the ground is still something useful to them where I sort of will walk past. But I've noticed now after being with them, and I'll pick up a 50-cent coin and I'll look at it. Before I wouldn't look at it, I just say, oh, that's a 50. Put it in your pocket. Now I'm like, interesting. Like, you know, I haven't seen one for a few weeks.
What do you think, Conrad?
Yeah. Don't really have any strong opinions on this.
that's a good
interesting hearing what you guys talk about.
No, that's all. It's a conservative answer. I mean, I funny story, when I was in high school, I remember we had like the canteen, and I remember like you'd always sometimes you'd see like coins on the ground that people had dropped, and it's like, oh, sweet, and then go and get something from the canteen. But now I think, man, you'd need to be seeing notes to be able to buy anything, you know, like you'd remember the 50-cent big ones and the 1-cent coins and that.
I remember the ones and the twos.
There's a funny thing actually on the LinkedIn, the Fiat Central, the Reserve Bank, that it was like 56 years, I think, since the decimalization of the New Zealand currency.
That'd be right.
1967. And they did a little bit of show and tell, you know, had a little video, and I commented, I was like, oh, what happened to the 1 and 2 cent coins? Why don't we have them anymore? And I'm just waiting to see there. Actually,
in 5 cent.
Sorry?
In 5 cent coins
Cent.
Gone too.
It was our lifetime went away.
And then they turned the 10 brown like the 1s and 2s used to be.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
I remember when I was a kid when $1 and $2 notes became coins. I remember that.
Well,
because that was 1990, I think, wasn't it?
I'll see if they've.
That was a big deal when that happened.
Would we?
Oh, they haven't replied. Let me see.
I remember thinking they were a flash because they were gold coloured.
Yeah.
Do you remember gold coin donations?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you, like Mufti Day or something.
Yeah.
And it was actually, it was worth not a lot, but it actually was worth quite a decent amount then. Well, that's hard to get across what I mean, but like.
Yeah. Purchasing power is.
Yeah, the purchasing power of $2 back then was, it wasn't tiny. Like if you could get a bottle of Coke or something like that.
I remember the dairy.
Yeah.
500 ml Coke dollar when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Then it went to $1.10, then $1.20.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah, that's right.
Three comments.
What are they now? $4 plus?
Something ridiculous.
I don't think they come in 500 mil. There's 600
mil. At the dairy, they'll be like $6, probably.
Oh,
you have to go to the supermarket to get them for $4.
On this day, 56 years ago, dollars and cents replaced pounds, shillings, and pence in New Zealand. Blah, blah, blah. And actually, this is quite interesting because... all right, so let me set the scene here. We're talking about a change of money. And if you run the adversarial media model of, you know, assuming that everything the media is doing has an intention and a reason to it, why are they suddenly talking now about changing the way money works in a country? Are they preceding the idea that the money's going to change? Because I've often thought the model of decimalization would be a good model for how you would move to a CBDC. Because you kind of do a bit of campaign, you do some PR, you know, this, all right, everyone, you know, April 1st, 2024, we're moving to the NZ digital dollar. You know, here's what you need to know. I could see that being a campaign. Mm. So, I'm sure this is just their social media person who's, I don't quite understand why the Reserve Bank of New Zealand needs a social media person, but, you know, they're just maybe doing this for fun, but running the adversarial, you know, maybe are they pre-situating, but here we go. A comment from Cody Ellingham. Hey, why don't we have the 1 and 2 cent coins anymore? And then someone else said, so after 56 years from NZ $1, £1 to one NZ dollar, 0.48 pounds. I don't quite know what that means, but I wonder if we were to run the exchange, relative exchange rates on both, how much the New Zealand dollar has slipped.
So, oh, did, was it a 1-to-1 when they created it in 1960?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So £1, I don't know. So it would have been £1 to one New Zealand pound, $1 to one New Zealand pound, sorry. So I don't know if the British pound...
I don't quite know my history of our money that well enough on that part of it, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a bit of a...
From what I understand, the exchange rate between the British pound and the New Zealand pound decreased precipitously over the time period it was around.
Yeah.
So it started... I think it started almost... It wouldn't have been 1-to-1, but it started pretty close to whatever it was, high-ish, and then it really just dropped over stages.
Yeah.
And they, I guess, again, thinking adversarially, like a pet hypothesis of mine, I don't have any evidence for this, which is why it's not a theory, but like, to me, it seems really obvious that the British government at the time did that as a way to transfer wealth from New Zealand to the British Crown.
Mm. Yeah, it is interesting, that relationship. You know, culturally, we are very close. We were, at least, very close to the UK. And you sort of see, I don't know, the way we were treated. I mean, obviously, the Anzac thing and that, you know, sort of the colonialists were sent in first. And that, yeah. You know, I think the scars of that are still here.
Sure.
You know, every small town in New Zealand has a Gallipoli memorial,
yeah.
Which people don't realise it was overseen by Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
Sending the Kiwis and the Aussies first.
And sending them to the wrong beach.
To the wrong beach. Oh, they didn't care.
Yeah.
And I think the resolution for that hasn't, in a way, it hasn't really been resolved.
There is a common pattern. Behavior though, if you look at all history and all wars, like if you gathered large forces together, you're going to send the periphery,
yeah.
You know, the homeland, what they considered the more valuable people were going to be given the main central safer, not safer necessarily, but you know, you're going to send in the colonized first, and
of course you will.
You know, and that's how it rolled in war. And I mean, it's a ruthlessly correct war decision, harshly. Having said that, perhaps as history has shown, it's not. I listened to a while back now, gosh, I can't remember the name of the podcast. There's this historian and he gave a fantastic account, like end to end World War One, and he said, and he was an American guy, but he said the consensus from all the research he'd gathered was that the toughest, most dependable, reliable soldiers on the Allied side were the Anzacs, and in particular the New Zealanders.
Yeah. Well, certainly in North Africa. The First World War is, I think, a bit of a different story. I mean, there were, obviously Gallipoli was the famous one, but there were New Zealand soldiers in, I'm just trying to think in terms of my ancestors, but I'm sure they were on the Western Front as well in some capacity. I think the First World War and Second World War were fundamentally different beasts, and the Dominion movement, I think the move away from the UK and the motherland really started after World War One, and the commitment, I think everyone was affected by the First World War in some capacity, whereas the draft and the commitment level of the Second World War, I haven't got the facts on this, but I believe it was less. Whereas it was all encompassing, I think everyone and their uncle went to fight in the First War. So,
the casualties and size of the Second World War was far larger. So, I'm not quite sure on that one.
I think if we were to look, the number 16,000 comes to mind, like New Zealand casualties from the First
War. Oh, sorry, I don't mean New Zealand, I just mean worldwide.
Yeah, so it was a bigger war, obviously, but I think the New Zealand commitment to it. And the losses and the kind of the horror, and even just, I think, the ability to get information about what happened. And yeah, sorry, it's a little bit out of my...
There's some pretty awful things about the Second World War from our perspective too. Like the, what did they call it? The J-Force? Was it the J-Force after the Second World War? So it felt like it was over and everyone was going to come back home to New Zealand. And then we suddenly redeployed them all off into the Pacific.
Okay.
And I know a great relative of mine, that was what happened. He fought for a long time in World War II, did amazing things, survived, only to go and perish while out for the J-Force, and the whole family was affected. Like, it felt like this giant shame. Like, he did this admiral thing. He did an amazing job. He was rewarded, awarded for his efforts. And then when the war was over, they shipped him off to this peacekeeping type force thing, and that's where he died. And it was all very sad. So I know that was, I remember my dad telling me a lot about the J-Force. So New Zealand supplied a large contingent to go and sort out all the Pacific. And again, my history might not be great on this, but so yeah, when it just felt like our families were all coming home, a large amount of them were deployed into the Pacific and had to go there for a while, and some died, etc. And it's all pretty sad when you feel like you've got this thing beat. I mean, same after World War One with the influenza epidemic as well, you know, everybody came home and brought the flu home, and then there was this great new travesty.
Yeah.
It's pretty harsh.
Modern war. Yeah, it's
fear wars.
It's both. Yeah, it's both fascinating. I think every young boy is interested in World War II to some degree, because it is such an all-encompassing event in history. And I don't know if that's still true today, but certainly there's just the imagery. You know, it's something within our psyche that we're losing. I think it's slowly drifting into history now, but certainly for me growing up, you know, there was a lot of film and a resurgence and interest in that period, and it was because it was so encompassing. Yeah, it was a world war,
and also all our grandparents were fighting.
And you're right, it's the world nature of the war that made that different. There's been plenty of war since the Second World War, but none of it like that, where it was really, you had the world massing into two opposing forces. I guess the difference now, which you'd never get now, is that people actually were in for that common cause. They saw enemy, they saw hate in their enemy, and they thought, we're doing the righteous thing. We must all band together and go and fight for someone we don't know, against someone we don't know, in a country we don't know. And yet they were 100% committed to that. I mean, that just is unbelievable to me. You can't really get that in the world today. You'll just be in an army getting paid. I mean, or alternatively protecting your land. Obviously, you'd passionately do that. But I just couldn't see where someone could. And you see lots of stories like out of the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts of, you know, like somebody, you see interviews with people who felt quite passionate after seeing the Twin Towers go down in New York and think, you know, this is what I'm going to do now. And it doesn't take long in Iraq before they just lose that whole romantic sort of ideal. And they're like, you know what? I made a mistake. This is trash.
It's almost like it's... you say that, though. Admittedly, it's forgivable for people to have not understood, because there was no media. I mean, there's no way to know. The newspapers and the radio was it. However, we're experiencing that now. You know, we've got war, a hatred for unknown culture, and foreign enemies as relevant now as it was then. And again, you know, I've been to China, I've been to Japan, I've seen the enemy, so to speak. I've seen the other side of it, you know. The Pacific War, you know, it's always, I always sort of cringe when I hear a Hollywood take, you know, Pearl Harbor or something, because there's a whole other story, which is another, you know, for another day. But just the way that war unfolded and the way the Japanese were set up and the internal issues that led to this tragic event, you know. And, you know, I've seen with my own eyes the scorch marks on Tokyo that are still there today, from the firebombings and all of these things that don't really get spoken about. In the firebombing of Tokyo, more people died than Hiroshima, but it's not talked about.
Well, I didn't know that.
My wife's grandfather was there as a young boy, and it was just wooden cities. 100,000 people died in one night. Same with Dresden and other parts of Germany were firebombed.
Yeah, I read about Dresden.
You know, Slaughterhouse 5, Kurt Vonnegut. But the story of that was so powerful to see the other side. And then you also learn about, say, China, you know, which is sort of the big bad wolf. You know, people hate China or whatever, but it's like, well, actually, when you work with Chinese people, you learn who they are, you learn their history, there's another side to it. And it feels like we're heading back into polarized world. Even Russia, Ukraine, man, I thought we were a global multicultural society now. Like, why are we still pinning people up and making them into the big bad wolf? Like, it's the media that are actually orchestrating this narrative. It's challenging, and I think, I mean, the more time I spend questioning things, you know, I realized just how failed we are by our fourth estate and the media. One of my motivations for having these kinds of conversations is to have a platform for long form discourse around these kinds of topics. And when you finally do turn the box on and you see what is actually the current media state, you think, man, this is just insufferable that they're literally spoon feeding people propaganda.
And
yeah, if you ask a lot of the creators of that content, they wouldn't see it that way.
I've met people.
That's what they're doing. But that is the end outcome. And it is, because like any other job, they've become very professional at it. And there's a process and there's a method. But when you follow that, you're no longer thinking about what you're there for, what you're really doing. And you're just thinking, I need to pump out this piece of content. This is how we do this type of content. These are the narratives. Here we go. Bang, bang, bang.
Yeah. Literally, I mean, I met with a guy. So we got, you know, stuff was just down the road. And I met a guy who works, he's up in Auckland, but he worked for TV1 doing some of the graphics, you know, motion graphics on there. You know, I was just about to say ad, but what do you call it? Like a piece. And he's like, yeah, you know, I had this piece about this crime. And so my editor was, oh, can you get like a shady looking kind of silhouette of a guy? And can you, you know, and so it's all orchestrated and mediated. Because if they wanted to make that guy look good and innocent, they'd be like, oh, you know, can you lighten it, make him smile? It's all editorial.
Yeah.
There's no truth. There's no fact anymore.
You do laugh when you see the pictures chosen for the articles. Like,
he's scorning.
You know, they'll get, you know, when they want to deride somebody, they'll get their face in a contorted in an awkward moment. And that story a while back, was it a Greenpeace hit piece? I can't remember. It was somebody, and it had a picture of a Bitcoin mining facility.
And they made it look all dirty.
And they filtered it, so it looked like there was a haze, as if there was some kind of emissions coming. It's just like, are you kidding me?
Like Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the broader space that we're entering, and I think I like to operate at this level, but it's challenging because, I mean, we went to a Bitcoin meetup, just a local meetup last night, and met with some people who are just interested in learning about how to secure a hardware wallet and seed phrase and stuff. And I realize all of us have gone so far into the journey, and we understand, I mean, we're operating at a level where we're talking about this kind of meta stuff, but it's actually like, there's actually a lot of proof of work required to get to that point.
Yes.
And we just assume that it's like turnkey, that you're going to get it. But it really is a challenge. I find it hard to communicate that.
When I first started to really understand Bitcoin myself, that is how I felt. I thought, oh, okay, so I can explain this to people better than what it's been explained to me. Like, I thought I can make this easier, you know? I can do this quickly. But the more you learn, the more you realize it's actually impossible. And I actually think a vast majority of people, there's nothing I can really say to make them get it.
Yeah.
The only way they're going to get it is to suddenly have the desire and motivation and curiosity to understand it themselves and educate themselves. Yeah. And all you can do is just help them
be available to answer questions.
Because we were speaking with someone who was quite into a lot of other coins and things. And I suffered that fate. I was trying to poke holes gently, politely, in the argument. In the end, I was sitting there in silence realizing this is silliness. It's like, I can't. The person will want to do this themselves. And so that was my last thought. And the last thing I said was, I grabbed that Bitcoin standard. I said, you should read this. And that was it. I never said another word. Nice. I was like, there's nothing else I can really do. And it's not fair. And I don't want to deride that person at all, because I was in the exact same phase. I've been through that. But yeah, the more you learn, the more you realize, as the saying goes, people are going to get Bitcoin at the price they deserve it. And they've got to want to teach themselves to get to there. And that's where they'll get to.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the other, adding to that, people don't necessarily need to get it, because it will just be. And there is room for visionaries. And I think it is a percentage of the population that can actually get it at the different stages that it's at. You know, earlier on, you know, I was there, but it didn't catch me. And it took a while to get me, and now it's got me. And for others, it will take longer. For many, they may never get it, but the world will move and change around them to the degree that they simply start using it.
Really glad you said that, because that's the caveat to all of it, because that is how it will be. I have a friend on the train I talk to about it sometimes. Like, she said he almost exactly that to her the other day. I said, you know, perhaps 99% of people, their first encounters and use of Bitcoin will just because there's a service or something that they do where suddenly it's just happening to them.
Mm.
And they'll never buy it. Because as I say, that's a limited use case that only happens until Bitcoin gets to a certain point of saturation, and then buying it as some kind of investment is no longer a use case. It's just a unit of account, along with everything else that it is. And so that's what I was saying to her. And that doesn't mean that those people won't feel like they lost anything or that they were late. None of that. It'll just be normal. I mean, that's how I adopted the internet. Exactly how.
Well,
you know, I didn't really, when I was a kid, I didn't understand what it was. All of a sudden, it was just part of things I had to do.
Let me flip it like this. Coming back to what we were opening with, talking about language, we've inherited the greatest language that has ever existed. You know, the ability for English to technically describe the schematics of a spaceship or a piece of technology, the ability of it to encompass poetry, literature, music, you know, everything. It's not as powerful as some languages in specific areas, you know, arguably, you know, some of the flow of Latin languages or some of the nuance of Japanese proverbs are lost in English, but we've inherited that and we didn't have to do anything. We just got it. And in a way, I wonder whether the inheritance of Bitcoin for future generations is going to simply be like, man, that they won't. In fact, they'll almost not appreciate what it was like if they hadn't have known what the fiat world was like. And for us to know, like, the word connection or the absolute abstract nouns that, you know, the words that we can use just freely, we didn't have to invent that. We didn't have to think that. We just have it. We don't conception, abstraction, the different network, you know, these kinds of words and abstractions and concepts that they just didn't exist, that you cannot talk about that in a vernacular language. They either have to use English and just take it as a loan word, or they just can't express that concept. Maybe Bitcoin is going to be like that, and to be like, man, what is a fiat money like? They'll try and imagine, but they won't be able to do it. You know, because it just will be. That's very optimistic, but
that's interesting. Another little thing I just crossed my mind about that is, you talk about if they couldn't express that because their language didn't allow it, if there was some concept or something that you couldn't literally voice, if you couldn't find a word for it, that is an exciting future of Bitcoin. There are things that we will be able to do with Bitcoin and things that Bitcoin will enable that have never been seen or thought of before. And that's going to be amazing. That's one of my favorite parts to think about with Bitcoin, is how much people haven't thought of yet that is going to come out of this. Like, yeah, the internet, sure. Again, I love always on my internet comparisons, but you know, there's just things that it's just so much bigger than even us think sitting here. And Andreas Antonopoulos is a good one to read to get you thinking about that, because he goes into some quite abstract ideas, you know, some of which won't come true, but some will. But more importantly, it gets you thinking, what other ideas are there? What, like when he talks about the streaming of value, that kind of blew my mind. Like saying, you know, we see the way we exchange value transactions and that we put boundaries on them. They're all time bound. You know, you pay something per hour or you pay something per item, you know, and then he starts really riffing on the concept of it can just be waves of value going back and forth all at the same time, almost like it's just flowing through the ether between us. And there doesn't have to be this time bound stuff. You know, you go to work and you start delivering value, and sats are just flowing into your wallet at the rate that you're delivering value. Yeah. Like those sort of kind of out there philosophy about what Bitcoin could enable.
Yep.
That really excites me, because that's just one little thing. I mean, that might not even happen, but there's tons of things out there like that that we're just going to be like, shit, man.
Yeah.
Fiat really was, you know, a square wheel, and then we found a round one.
Mm. Yeah. The change that's going to take place is going to be so profound. I've got a little quote here from this book. So human knowledge is constantly advancing. We live in a later age than the Percilian Greeks and the Augustan Romans. Therefore, we are wiser. Therefore, anything we write or make is better than the things written and made by the ancient Greeks and Romans. And that's posited as a criticism. Mm. We think that we are better.
Yes.
And I think there's a duality there, which is that we both think that we're better than the past and there's nothing to learn. But at the same time, we can make things that drastically paradigm shift and move things forward.
Mm, yeah.
And there's both of those things happening at the same time.
Mm.
Yeah.
So we can learn, like, what is sound money like? We can learn from the ancient times, but then we can also improve it.
Yeah.
And that's how progress happens.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of stories of lost technology.
Yeah.
That took them hundreds, if not thousands of years to recover or to catch back up on. Is it the... I always remember there was one, I think it was Chinese steel or something like that.
Oh, Damascus steel?
Something they made. And
Roman concrete as well.
Yeah, the aqueducts are still standing.
I saw something about Roman concrete just the other day as well, like that. Yeah, and it was for hundreds of years. They couldn't make anything that good. And so it was a huge premium placed on finding something 300 years old because it's going to be better than anything we can make right now. It's amazing. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's powerful, and that is, again, like learnings, like what can we learn from the past and synergize and integrate with what we're doing today. And I think that's where maybe the analogy with language could work, you know, because the English language, modern contemporary languages, you know, even Japanese, Chinese, they have loan words and concepts, and they're always evolving, but they're so much more powerful and diverse because they encompass everything that was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is still English that you can read. Old English is challenging, but you know, after that, Middle English and modern English is still, you know, a couple of hundred years ago, you can read that and integrate that into what you do. And so we build upon that. It's like, yeah, iterative, and it evolves. And our concepts of money have evolved in the same way, and we've gone through different kind of journeys, and we've lost many things along the way, but we've also gained things now with this idea of Bitcoin, of sound money. We've come back to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've kind of reconverged on what good is. And yeah, arguably, you know, the future, you know, people who are born within the Bitcoin era, they might not even be able to imagine what it was like. Because it's really hard for us, you know, like the mindset, to put yourself into the mindset of an ancient person. It's actually really challenging because you bring the paradigm of modernity to the old times, you know, paganism, all of their, you know, pre-Christian values. Like even the Greeks, they didn't have, and the Bible isn't, you know, it's not something that's in everyone's life every day anymore, but it is fundamental to society in this country, everything we do.
Mm.
The way we treat other people is born from it's born from that 2,000 years ago. And so before that, what inspired, you know, what did young people in society, what was it built upon? That was where, like, the Homeric epics and the Odyssey and that came, you know, they filled that role. And so for us moving forward, what will the foundation of society be built upon? What sort of values, as we lose so much through this kind of disinformation era that we're experiencing.
That's why I love Bitcoin so much, because its values and principles are just perfect to me.
It's a renaissance of ideas.
It's like an immaculate conception of values. It really is. It just fits so well, because the idea of, you know, the way the fiat society works is everybody acts like everybody should have goodwill or be good or have charity, and they're actually not incentivized to do that other than how people perceive them. There's no other incentive, and so that results in people wanting to appear on the outside that they're this kind of person, but the incentives inside are driving them to behave differently. So there's a nature of an opaque dishonesty. And so, you know, you meet someone for the first time and they tell you some things about them, and they tell you some good things and things that they do. You're always thinking, okay, so, but who is this person really? because it doesn't tell you that that's what the person they are. That's what they would like you to think about them, and they are doing some things like that to appear that way. But you know that actually inside them, the fiat world is that they're not incentivized to continue behaving like that at all times. So you're just having the presented version of them, and it's just a complete change in the world where suddenly you have Bitcoin, which will go into everything, and the incentives align with honesty and these other values that are just good. And to actually behave that way, you've got to. And then bringing back to the sound of a miner humming in the background, that's why I find it good. Like, what other just persistent little hum would you really enjoy?
Exactly.
Other than knowing that we are listening to those principles, you're putting in the work to earn some value. I mean, it's far more satisfying and worth the premium of expending a little bit more cost for the same amount of Bitcoin, because it's you're doing the work instead of just paying somebody else to do the work and paying a little bit less, and you put it in your wallet, you forget about it. Instead, you're on your work day and you hear that hum and you're like, cool, I'm doing... You're
doing the maths yourself.
I've got something that's going to blow your mind. So in Buddhism, there's this sacred phrase, they call it, and it's the letters like OM, like and that's why monks kind of hum to themselves. And I mean, it's sort of a thing they do. And in a way, the sound of the miner humming away is the sound of absolution, epsilon, of all things within one. The sound that the monk makes, you know, in his monastery up on the hill. The sound of the miner.
Bitcoin monasteries.
Mining away. The reverence for the time when mortal men were able to mine and exchange on the base chain. You know, they were able to interact with the base layer of the global universal value system that is Bitcoin. And they were able to do it with just, you know, a flick of a switch. They could mine. Wow. You know, there'll be Dyson spheres. And was it the civilization types we were talking about?
Kardashev's
civilization scales, you know, where they're using the entire output of soul of the sun to mine, you know, a single UTXO, a single Bitcoin. And
maybe
sorry, I mean, that's getting a bit epic, but that kind of visionary thinking is like, we in the fiat system and in the government world, government run money, we don't have that vision. Whereas if you go to the Greeks, they talk about Mount Parnassus, the muses, the muses who spoke, you know, Zeus, the kind of the Greek gods, you know, they had this whole, you know, menage, this whole stable of gods for everything. And I mean, that's paganism, but it was exciting, and they had their thing, and they had their temples, and they sacrificed, and they had a paradigm that we cannot conceptualize what that means today in a Christian world. But the way they operated was fundamentally different, yet somehow they were able to achieve this liveliness and this beautiful society and culture that we can still appreciate.
They definitely had a vision of getting to abundance and adding value for everyone. And and now we've reversed that, and we're like, let's do degrowth and all the other nonsense.
Well, even like festivals, I mean, the festivities is a very pagan thing. And I'm not espousing this as a value or a positive, but it's a thing they did. You know, and they would all get together and have the feast. And and it's like, man, when was the last time anyone had a feast with just the people around them? Like, I mean, you do it with your friends or whatever, but like,
but do we anymore? Hardly.
I mean, but Kiwi, we have a feast.
We do have a feast. We will have a feast.
Let's go.
But actually, it's ironic you say that, because I just came from
a Matariki
celebration, and that was the theme. So a couple of people organized it, and they were talking about what this means and running through a few things, and they talked a lot about a feast and getting family and friends together, and they were really encouraging. But I could see when I looked around the room, people going through the motions, they're sort of looking, oh yeah, okay. And I looked around and think, nobody's going to do this. But I appreciated what they were trying to put across. They were like trying to encourage people. You should really get some people together this weekend and, you know, appreciate them. Cook some good food that may not necessarily be healthy, relax, rest with your family, appreciate them, just let it go a bit and just have, you know, just take a break.
So maybe this is the Matariki special for the transformation of value, but we're having a good chat over lunch with Conrad just over the idea of an enforced public holiday and talking just soliloquy on just, you know, what is a public holiday? Because, I mean, I don't get one. You know, I work for myself. I take time off when I need it and that, but, you know, what is the role of the government to set a new public holiday? What does that mean?
Yeah. It's a whole... I'm on this wavelength as well. A couple of friends I've talked to about this before, and we all sort of came to consensus, we think, without putting a lot of thought into this, but just on the face of it, we're sort of like, well, why don't we just have a set number of days every year, and you get those as public holiday leave days, and you choose and take those where you want. I mean, not everybody celebrates Christmas, Easter. I mean, and it's funny because most people that do seem to be very anti-Christian these days, and yet these are Christian-based holidays. So they've lost their essential meaning for most people in New Zealand. But yeah, I was of that thought, and you know, telling you can't open your store on a particular day. You know, if you're a Jewish person that celebrates Hanukkah and you don't do Christmas at all, why can't you open up your store Boxing Day? I mean, God, it's all become a bit silly. Like, it feels like a lot of these things had good reasons and kind of fit once before, but it feels like we've gone beyond that a bit. I mean, we're not in a world where everyone demarcates everything by the weekend. I mean, a lot of us do because we work Monday to Friday because it's the relic of the system, but it's sort of, these are old traditions now that aren't necessarily rooted in logic.
When you break down the language of Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I mean, in Japanese, for example, they have characters associated with them as well. Chinese are just like day one, day two, day three. Like, there's no, I think Sunday has it's got a special name, but like the other days are just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And like the history and the culture of it, it's archaic. And it's a human construction. Like, if anything, the lunar cycle is the only thing that really matters, and the annual, you know, the seasons. But besides that, the week, what does that even mean? How do we get there? And the role of the government, and kind of the hubris to say, well, it's a public holiday, because arguably, and no offense to anyone who works for the government, but the only people who I know who are going to actually have a good old time off are probably in the public service, and they're already working remotely and slacking off half the week anyway. The people
I don't know about that. Oh, the private industry observes public holidays.
It's small businesses.
A contractor is the difference, really. A personal.
Yeah, it's small business. It's just us. The worker's taking a day off. The business has to cop that. So it's like the only people who can really afford it are big corporates, government adjunct, and the government.
That is true.
I mean, I don't get Matariki off. I'll be doing some stuff tomorrow, but like everyone else gets to just chill, and they're already chilling. And so it's actually... And we were talking to someone else about this, and he was saying, well, you know, what about retail workers and all of that? And the concept we were trying to explain is the Austrian, we were trying to do an impromptu Austrian economics lecture, but basically everyone pays for public holidays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, like, the best way to do welfare economics, which is what we're doing here, and we're discussing the welfare implications of a policy, like, the best way to do that is to just say, look, everyone is a consumer. Just fundamentally. And so what is going to be the effect on consumers if you have this policy? Well, if you have this policy of a public holiday, then there's just less stuff being produced. So consumers are harmed, like, unambiguously.
Run the scenario all the way. What if every day was a public holiday?
And we go through. I don't think you need to do that.
365, okay, I mean, it's mayhem, right?
Yeah.
And then what if we had no public holiday? And even, I mean, you use the word workers... I mean, this language for me is archaic language.
Yeah.
Like, what is work? It's like, what is money? What does work even mean? Because I would arguably, and a lot of the work that we're all connected with is kind of somewhat fiat-based. It's fiat as in it doesn't actually mean anything. Real human production capabilities are a lot higher than what we do, like, because it's all misallocated by government funding, right? So, you know, you get busy work.
Yeah, you do.
And you do your 40 hours and you're remoting, zooming in and blah, 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 but there's no productive output. That's the government's modus of doing things. in a free market, yeah, we could probably just have 3-day work weeks. That's what was promised post-war. Why don't we have that? I want my 3-day work week.
For sure.
My 3-day, and 4 days of leisure.
Maybe even if we were productive enough to have a 3-day work week, you know, you would still work 5 or 6 days a week and just live.
It's belonging.
Lavishly, man.
It's belonging. I mean, and especially for us young men, I mean, we work. That's what we do.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I think this is Marcus Aurelius. He's like, the olive tree produces olives, the vine produces grapes, and men work.
Yeah.
That's what we do.
I like that.
And it's like in our DNA.
Yeah.
Whether we're chopping rocks or writing software.
Yeah.
And the image of the remote work of the PlayStation, of the beneficiary of the pod, the imagery that's promoted of Netflix, of Apple Vision Pro over your head and watching TV, that's not what we do.
No.
Hey, brother, you going to join in? Come on. Sorry, bro. Did you text me? Yeah, no, we got a mic set up for you, man. We're probably going to wrap up in a minute, but we just had our resident mining expert join. We haven't got headphones for you, sorry, but
I can hear you guys.
Yeah,
cool, man.
So we got our resident mining expert joined us. 3D printing, immersion cooling. We've just wrapped up a soliloquy on the relationship between the English language and the power of Bitcoin as a universal value language. Would you say that's right, guys?
Mm. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, we've gone deep. Yeah. Sorry. I've pulled them back from...
I had a thought I wanted to add. You said right up at the front, the beginning, the classic Bitcoin saying, stay humble and stack sats, and how do you stick to that? Mm. Part of our discussion was we were talking about incentives, and it takes care of itself. And this is, again, those Bitcoin values and incentives. It incentivizes you to stay humble. And to stack sats.
Yeah,
because there is actually nothing more important to a Bitcoiner than their reputation.
Mm.
You reckon?
I believe this because we just know so many past revered Bitcoiners that have drowned and just ruined their reputations. They
drowned in the river of hubris.
Yeah. They've become fear incentivized somewhere along the way and lost their way. And also going back to something I spoke to you about, like, it's a Bitcoin principle to don't trust, verify. But because Bitcoiners say that, they can be trusted because they believe that. So you naturally have a trust. So the incentives just line up beautifully. And the incentive to stay humble is stack sats is because it's the incentive in all of Bitcoin is to be humble and stack sats because you're going to do better if you do those two things.
For sure, man.
I have an economic reason. I agree with everything you said. But I also have an economic reason. Because there's no inflation, although there is inflation until the mining reaches its asymptote, you know, but it's predictable at least. Because there's no inflation, you're more inclined to save and spend on more important things. Mm. So there'll be fewer cafes, but maybe more long-term focused things when you don't have an inflationary currency. Mm. So that incentivizes you to hold instead of to spend now. Because your dollar today is not as valuable as your dollar tomorrow.
Mm.
So you make longer term decisions with your purchases instead of immediate short term decisions like buying the third coffee for the day, which makes more sense in an inflationary world
in Wellington shut down Magnetics.
Magnetics.
And I blame the government's inflationary tactics on that. So I can no longer buy three coffees a day. So it's kind of, the problem has solved itself.
Say that I bought three coffees today and
shitcoiner.
You just gave me an epiphany on it though, because I bought three coffees, I paid fiat for three coffees. If those three coffee retailers had only accepted Bitcoin, I would have bought zero coffees today.
And that's a good thing, because you're making better purchasing decisions.
Yeah,
because it's not inflationary, it's worth more.
Yeah. Stack sets.
Just adding to that though, so we had can I say your name?
Troy.
Yeah. Troy. I wasn't sure if he's a NIM or not, but we got Troy, mining expert. Talking about staying humble, stacking sats, replace the word stacking sats with actually just doing work, because the sats come, they will flow, and you can buy them currently, but you'll have to do work in the future. And so what I'm impressed, you know, Troy's helped a lot with this mining, the meditative hum in the background, you know, and really, you know, the om of mining. But he's, you know, helped print some ducts and, you know, adapters to put the tubing on. And I'm really thankful for that. And it's been a really learning experience. But that's work. And that's like the desire to be productive and to create. And all of us here, the four of us, have been working on that journey to be productive and to create and to not just try and ride the wave of it, you know, the get rich quick kind of vibe, which I sometimes see emerge around me. And I think we saw a little bit of it last night at that other event. And I see that within myself, because that is an initial feeling that you have, you know. It's like falling in love for the first time. It's a feeling. You could say there's a label that you can associate with that vibe, that feeling.
People watching the line as it goes up and down.
Before you go, we were doing an audio check earlier, me and Conrad, and we were playing, do you remember the Pump It Up song?
Yeah.
Pump it up. You know, and it's got, floor is dropping.
Oh, no. You know, I gotta pump it up. You know, and that's like the Bull Run song. And it's got the guy Money Printing and the little animations and stuff. And I was thinking, man.
Mine was from Kunk on Earth. I don't know if you watch that series, but they got Pump It Up on there. It's a different, anyway.
Okay, no, all good.
Well, all I mean, the Kunk on Earth people understand.
Kunk on Earth, is that a band? Or?
No, they're like an English mockumentary.
It's
worth watching, guys.
Yeah. Okay. No, coming back to the culture of the Bull Run, I was like, man, I'm so thankful. Like this couple last year or whatever, it's like, man, so much has happened, and price is irrelevant.
Absolutely.
Well, the vast majority of people, that's how they're introduced to Bitcoin, is through
Pump It Up.
Yeah, is, oh, maybe this is me. It's how I came in, and I like to giggle when people try to claim otherwise, because it reminds me of when a 14-year-old starts smoking. They're like, "Why do you start?" And they're like, "Oh, relaxes me." It's cool. And it's like, you did it because you thought it was cool. No, I didn't. But it's the same getting into Bitcoin. Just 99% of people got in because they thought there was money to be made and get rich quick. And then suddenly they discovered there's something else.
Now they're philosophy
and
kings.
Yeah. And they're here talking ancient Greek.
Now they're philosophy kings. Exactly. They're experts suddenly. They're all economists.
Yeah. Well, we have one bona fide economist.
We do.
In the
room. Do we?
But everyone is an economist in Bitcoin. Yeah.
And now the hum of a miner is a monk meditating.
Bitcoin monastery.
Yeah. You know, it's good, guys. Well, look, I think we've covered I was going to say menage again, but we've covered many topics today. The Matariki special, it's been good. This is what I wanted. I'm glad Troy did join at the end. He was waiting for us on his lonesome, downstairs, locked out of the building, I believe. Sorry, I didn't see them. I'm sorry. We'll mean to say. But we might wrap it there, guys. Paul, Conrad, Troy. And Cody here in my, and obviously the miners going, they will continue to go through the night until the early morning. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Cody.
Thank you.
Catch you later.
See you, guys.
Thank you for listening. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I am Cody Allingham, and that was the Transformation of Value. If you'd like to get in touch, please send me an email at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com, and I will get back to you.